If the world has two superpowers, it's the U.S. and China. We know the choppy waters America is navigating, but China has its challenges too. Many in its wealthy business class are leaving. They're just frustrated with the authoritarian government, and they're setting up shop in other countries. China's population is actually dropping as it ages, a natural consequence of economic success that they've had in the recent past. This will almost certainly bring an economic slowdown. Its COVID policy is turning out to be what seems like a total mess, reflecting badly on the competence of the government, and it's a government that needs to protect its image. And the country has experienced public demonstrations lately as a result. Zach Deichwald has been spending years in China studying its youth scene, and he joins us today to share his take on the recent challenges in China. Zach, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Now, it seems that there's a lot to catch up on in regards to China. But before we do, let's catch up with you. First of all, remind us of your work with the Young China Group and the book you've written.
Yeah, gosh, the first time I got to join you and your wonderful audience, I think Young China had just come out. I had a book written about, the subtitle is How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World, really focusing on the emerging identity of young people throughout the country, focusing particularly on second and third tier cities. So trying to get out of the Shanghais and the Beijings and talk to real people. And the basis for this, and later my organization, the Young China Group, is trying to bring a people first perspective of China to the world for a better world. And the reason is pretty simple. You know, when we talk about China, you know, even of course in the news especially, and even your headline reflected this a little bit, we talk about two different versions. First is a big government, which is scary. Right? And second is a big economy, which is either exciting or scary, depending on the day. And so the people first approach is one that's far more accessible, understandable, and empathetic. And it's one that I've been trying to advocate for really for the last 6, 7, 8 years now.
Wow. And when you talk about focusing on second tier cities, in the United States, that would be maybe 300,000 or 500,000 people. In China, a second-tier city is how big?
So I lived in a sleepy little city called Chengdu that had an 8 million person population, depending on how you counted. One of the best sort of cocktail party lines I have is New York is the smallest city I've lived in the last decade. And, you know, living in China, it's the land of big numbers.
Well, you know, a billion people is 1,000,000,000, and that's a lot of big cities.
A lot of big cities.
Hey, something's going on in your personal life also. I understand you just got married to a wonderful, apparently, partner who's Chinese.
That's right. And it's a zany story. So I got married 6 months ago, but we met in March of 2020. Taking it back even 2 months before that, in January of 2020, I packed for a 2-week trip from Beijing to the U.S. to speak at a couple of conferences. And on January 24th, I had a ticket back to Wuhan, China. My book was coming out in China. I was filming something with Tencent, which is one of the largest tech and media companies there. I got messages from my friends in Wuhan at the beginning of January saying, hey, you know, maybe push back your flight. I did, and ultimately ended up in New York come March. Now I go on a date on March 11th, which was just about the last day you were allowed to date in New York City. And by March 13th, we had moved in together, preparing to quarantine with one another. Because we'd both seen, so she's from Qingdao, China, a beautiful city on the coast. We'd both seen what had happened in China. We knew it would be bad, probably worse than what people were talking about in the States. And so over the next few months, from not knowing one another, we then started to spend every single waking moment together at the beginning of what has been a wonderful and in many ways charmed relationship and now marriage.
What a decision. You felt the rising tide of a pandemic before other people did. Because you were heading back to the epicenter of that, and you had to make a quick decision with your wife, and it worked out great. So you could call that a corona bonus.
Definitely a corona bonus. It's love in the time of corona. We've been through it. You know, we've constantly been thinking we were going back to China, and we've thought that just about every month for the last 24 months. We had a major medical crisis in Mexico. Actually, my fiance at the time almost passed. Fortunately, she did not. She's made a full tremendous recovery. And, you know, it's a lot of ups and downs. And as I know, a lot of people around the world and the country have felt. And now we are finally planning, after a full 3 years since I've left, to get back to China and, among other things, meet my in-laws.
Zach Deichwald created the Young China Group to help Western interests better understand China and the expectations of its younger generation. Zach provides his clients with a China Preparedness Index to clear up misperceptions before doing business in China. He's joining us right now from Mexico City. You'll find links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Your whole work is helping people better understand the people and the business environment and the culture of China. And that is so constructive lately. And I'm so tuned into the fact that, like most Americans, what I know about China is basically what I see in the news. And you've got a much more intimate connection. And what do you think the average American doesn't appreciate about China that they should?
I think first, and this has been foremost in people's minds, especially the last 9 months. First is, the average person in China does not feel the presence of their government at every waking moment. And this is something that's really hard to square. I think when people imagine me arriving in China, they sort of imagine I get dispatched a sort of big brother-like official who then sort of follows me around 100 meters behind me. And that's sort of my life as the months unfold. You know, before 9 months ago, the saying I used most often to help people understand the relationship between people and government is Tiangao Huangdiyuan. It roughly translates to the hills are high and the emperor is far away. For the most part, the government is not an active part of people's daily lives. The major exception, of course, has been certainly these last 9 months since the Shanghai lockdowns, but even the last 3 years since COVID began, it's been a far more present relationship with the government than has existed for my, you know, I've been in and around China for almost 15 years now. So that's a big shift.
Maybe that's an interesting byproduct of COVID, is the government is more in people's lives than in the past. I would think there's sort of an unwritten arrangement that as long as we have stability and the freedom to be materialistic and have, you know, some kind of a happy life and a material capitalistic kind of way to, you know, enjoy life, people will let the government be authoritarian, but that can only go so far.
So this is what I think of as the bargain. And this is the question that I get asked probably the most is what is the state of the bargain between the people and the government?
The perceived
bargain is, will provide progress, opportunity, jobs, upward mobility, and you, the people, will provide obedience. Now, I don't think that's as direct a relationship, a causal relationship, as it's often portrayed. Again, I think people far underestimate the pride that especially young people feel in what their country and government has accomplished. And in China, there's the ability to separate country and government,
right?
People and government. So when people think of China's progress over the last 30 years, you know, crazy number for you, in the last 33 years, so since 1990, so 32, 33 years, China's per capita GDP has increased 33 times, an incredible number. In the United States, that number is around 3.1. And so China is quite unique in this. When you look around the world, like India, it's 6x over the last 33 years. Brazil, 3.2. Germany, 1.9, I believe. And so when we're imagining that from the outside, we typically think about government, right? But in China, my friends there have watched their villages turn into towns, turn into cities. They watched an uncle be excited about wheeling a bicycle home as a sign of wealth in the early 1990s to having a two-car garage. It's a much more personal shift that's not government related, with, of course, some government interaction, support, and encouragement.
Zach Deichwald is joining us from his home studio in a lively neighborhood of Mexico City right now on Travel with Rick Steves, before returning to a reopened post-pandemic China. Zach explains how watching the World Cup on TV led to massive street protests across China. That's in a website extra at ricksteves.com/radio. You wrote in your newsletter, I think, how an American would be impressed by the infrastructure in China. We might think of it as a developing nation, but that's old news. The infrastructure would blow you away when you go to the cities, even those second-tier cities of only 6 or 8 million people. The infrastructure is quite jaw-dropping.
So between 2011 and 2013, China poured more concrete than the United States did in the entire 20th century. Now, I don't want to make this all about infrastructure, and I especially don't want this to be a US-China, which is better. I think there's a lot of, that's a nuanced conversation. What I will say is the way that the speed at which the country changes is unbelievable. The last 3 years have been a unique period in the last 33.
Oh, yeah.
And then also the technology, by the way. So like, not only is it just buildings, you know, you can see the Shanghai skyline from 1990 to 2020, and it's a really astonishing shift, but also the technology, you know, people's willingness to be a mobile first nation. When a lot of brands and organizations and tech organizations around the world are thinking, okay, which is the most mobile first country that we need to model ourselves after? It's China now. And that's really been the case since around 2015.
Well, 2022 has been a tough year, was a tough year, and 2023 is looking like a tougher year. Does that have something to do with the fact that, what, 700 million people in China are under 40 years of age and they're restless?
So the last year has been brutal, and there's no other way to describe it. Really beginning with those Shanghai lockdowns, which about 9 months, 10 months ago in the realm of that. And time, by the way, has been moving in crazy ways. Feels like once every 2 weeks, there's another, you know, it's like, what's the crisis du jour that we're trying to navigate? But there's been a pretty difficult sentiment shift over the last 9 months. And I will say we've passed the nadir and are on an upswing now. So it's actually a good time to talk about this. But there was this feeling within China that the opportunities were shrinking. The glimmers of hope at the end of the COVID tunnel were diminishing, and that the on-again, off-again economy of COVID China, which is where you don't know, you know, if you run a business, you don't know if you're going to be open 4 weeks of the month, 3 weeks of the month, 2 weeks of the month. You don't know if you're going to have foot traffic like you normally do because of COVID lockdowns. You don't know if you're going to be able to hire people at the rates that you normally do because you can't predict your revenue, and you don't know how often people are going to show up to work. Over time, the exhaustion and the fatigue that comes from that really impacted people's spirits. And so when we saw those protests, which of course were, you know, ostensibly the result or in reaction to a major fire and some tragic deaths in Xinjiang as related to COVID lockdowns, they really were much more than that. They were a venting of pent-up frustration. And this is where nuance is important, not necessarily against bad government, which is how it was often portrayed, but certainly massive amounts of anger against bad policy that had led people to a severely restricted life.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Zach Dykewald, and he's the founder and head of the Young China Group, and he's the author of a book called Young China: How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. He's updating us with his observations of China this year and what he expects to find as he returns to live in China shortly. Zach's website is youngchinagroup.com. Zach, there's some interesting demographic and people movement kind of action going on now. I was reading about how the wealthy class, the business class, has had it with the unpredictable dimension of their authoritarian government, and many are moving away and setting up shop in places like Singapore. And then I've also heard that the natural consequence of all their success is people become more affluent and better educated, and anywhere on the planet when that happens, people live longer and they have fewer children. Consequently, China looks now to a near future where they'll have fewer workers and more pensioners. And this is both of these factors, business leaders leaving the country and an aging population, it's going to have a consequence on their stability and on their economic well-being and growth going forward. What's your take on that?
Well, demographers love to say demography is destiny. And China has really been a beneficiary of that. You can really tell the story of China's growth post-1980s as a story of demography. Rick, do you have any guesses for what the population in China in 1950 was? So 1950, midway through the 20th century. Today, the population is 1.4 billion. 1950, what's your guess?
300 million.
300 million is actually a great guess. Most people guess about 1 billion or 1.2 or something like that. The answer was 540 million. Now, this is also baby boomer territory, right? So between 1950 and 1980, China's population increased by 440 million people.
So they've got a baby boomer generation which is later than ours and bigger than ours.
It's longer than ours. It's later by about 4 years because between 1945, when World War II ended, and 1949, there was a civil war between the nationalists and, of course, Mao's communists.
Right.
And Mao won. And as he did, people started to settle down and shack up. And it led to incredible birth rates. So between 5 and 6 kids per family. And Mao, while he did a tremendous amount of things wrong, one of the things that people benefited from was significantly decreased infant mortality. So more people were living, more people were staying alive. And so China has the biggest baby boom in the world, followed by the world's largest baby bust, beginning with the one-child policy around 1980. And so if demography is destiny, China has been tampering with its own fate.
Because they've exaggerated it with these two factors. I mean, really fast and then really slow.
Absolutely. So if you imagine a demographic pyramid, in 1950 all the way through 1980, you have a lot of young people, so broad on the base, and very few old people. In 1950, the average life expectancy in China was 40. So you weren't retiring and taking a cruise, you'd die. And also, China was incredibly poor at the time, so this is why baby boomers don't register in China, because some different than baby boomers in the United States, who impacted the economy at every single life stage, in China, they didn't have that spending capability. But in 1980, 1990, when China had its reform and opening policy, basically beckoning in the manufacturing era of China, all of those young people were of working age. And during communist China under Mao, the more they worked, it didn't necessarily lead to them earning more. But suddenly, the more they worked, the more they could earn for their families. And so this is called the Eat Bitter Generation, 吃苦的一代. They were extraordinarily hardworking. And so in factories, that meant asking for extra hours because it was the first time in their life where they could work more and change the lives of their families and also future generations. Now, the problem today is a couple of things. First, you have that baby bust, which is unique to China, and the one-child policy. But you also have urbanization. Now, once you move into a city, kids just mean cost. Right. And so I remember in 2015, when the one-child policy was officially relaxed, the beginning of it, I was going around the country doing interviews in China, asking young parents or young prospective parents, you know, are you going to have a second kid? And the most consistent answer I got was no, because a second child would make both children half as competitive. The amount that they were able to spend on their children in terms of education, the opportunities they were able to give them would basically be cut in half. And competition is such a defining element of the project of childhood in China that these young parents basically made a business decision for their kids in order to try to give them the best chance possible of really thriving into their future and young adulthood.
Zach Dykewald shares what he sees in common between the people of Mexico and China in just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves. His website is youngchinagroup.com.